This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for January 27th, 2015. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels, and I thank you as always for being here. And if you've been waiting for this episode, then you've been waiting a while. Thanks for waiting, those of you who wait, those of you who are excited when the new ones come out. Special shout out to Ben, who's probably listening to this on a beach or near a beach in Grenada. How's Grenada? I hope good. Anyway, I'm not going to offer any excuses for why it's been a while. Sometimes it's a while because life happens. Instead, as per usual, what I'm going to do is reward your faith with some new stuff. We're going to have two episodes coming out much closer together than we normally do. Next time, we're going to have Zach Barth, creator of Spacechem and Infiniminer and the other Infina games, and most recently Infina Factory. First things first, though, this time round, we are going to be talking to Dan Teasdale. You may know him from his work on the Rock Band games, or Destroy All Humans, or maybe his time at Twisted Pixel. But he's here right now to talk about his new indie studio, No Goblin, that he founded with Panzer, if you're familiar with Panzer. The two of them just finished their debut game, for their new studio, as their new studio, and it's called Roundabout. Roundabout combines a core gameplay mechanic that is as compelling to master as it is delightfully physically nonsensical. You have to drive, right? You have to drive an ever-revolving stretch limousine around a big open world. The limousine can jump, it can go on water, it's wonderful and it makes no sense, and I love it. And the story of the game is told through full motion video that has a sort of Black Dynamite-esque love of, dodgy production. I think the entire package is delightful. I had a great time talking to Dan about it and about lots of other things. Dan and Zach are two of the most overwhelmingly enthusiastic and passionate and positive people that I've ever had the pleasure of talking to, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Zach next time, and right now, my conversation with Dan Teasdale. Okay, so I'm starting now.
Excellent.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it.
Hey, not a problem.
So I love the game. Like, loved it a lot. Like, I had a friend over, actually, and we played through most of it together and had just big, goofy smiles on our faces the entire time, so.
Oh, that's awesome to hear.
It's funny because he, my friend who I had over, is a film geek primarily. Like, he likes games, but he's not as into them as I am. And he really, like, the FMV sequences, I think he felt like could have almost been their own thing.
Wow, that's super flattering, because I have zero film experience besides, starring in FMV at Twisted Pixel. So the fact that I passed, like, a film buff's kind of bar is yeah, maybe that's my new career now, is director.
Well, what he said, and maybe this is just that you have good instincts or whatever, but he said that it's impossible to make the kind of purposeful, charming mistakes that Roundabout makes with dodgy production and stuff unless you know what you're doing, right? It seemed like it was all wielded very intentionally. You know, all the choices were or Mickey the Mechanic's grease moving around on his face and the background's not changing and, the shameless use of stock footage and, like, all that stuff seemed to him really literate kinds of, charmingly schlocky gestures.
Yeah, most of those were deliberate, yes. Stuff like a lot of prop stuff, especially, is me dropping the ball on getting the right props, and then Panzer on the day, like 5 minutes before we're filming, like taping battery system gloves, and that's our prop. so most of it is deliberate, and the rest is a nice accident, I guess.
Sure, absolutely. So let's take a step back. We dove right in, and that's cool. But Maybe you would like to take a crack at this, although I'm sure you're tired of getting asked it. How would you describe Roundabout to somebody who you think might be in its target audience but doesn't know it yet, right? Someone who has not heard about the game so far.
So I would describe Roundabout It's a 70s B-movie game. It's also a puzzle game. The whole goal is to drive a constantly revolving limousine around a big city. Which sounds easy when you say it like that, but it's a very, like, the limousine is constantly spinning and you're having to move it around parked cars and buildings and things like that. Which is kind of, to equate it to, like, something else, it's like rubbing your belly and patting your head. Like, it's a very unnatural way to move around, I guess. And so the entire game is basically that, telling the story of Giorgio Manos, who's the world's first revolving limousine driver. And so we have a full motion video that we were talking about before to basically tell this rise to fame story of Giorgio Manos.
And it's also, so the other thing that makes it literate in terms of, you know, to a film geek's eye is that it has this kind of, you know, self-awarely broken three-act structure like a Hollywood movie might, in the way that a 70s B-movie might have, right? That it has this kind of rise and fall and trials and tribulation stuff going on, but in rather ridiculous ways, which I will not spoil here, but...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of it is, like, some of it's inspired by movies, but a lot of it is inspired by the behind-the-music sort of structure of you're starting out, and then they get big... but at a cost, and they drop down, and then you have the you know, oh, and everything is going to resolve in the future, maybe, kind of thing. And so we kind of borrowed from that a lot when building out our structure.
I want to go back to something else you said, which is that it's a puzzle game, and it definitely is, right? It's about, I kept wanting to compare it to Octodad, in the sense that you're doing things that might or probably would be easier with a more normal control scheme. At least it seems that way until a certain mission, which again, I won't spoil. It's more interesting because you're doing it in this kind of sideways way. And what made me not want to compare it to Octodad is that whereas, you know, the joy of Octodad is the sort of imprecision of the control scheme, Roundabout is really, really precise. It's just precise with this, you know, preposterous, physically impossible convention that it starts with.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think one review mentioned that it was like, there's like a delightfully sloppy narrative around a super, like, demanding, precise gameplay, which I think is like a nice way of sort of summarizing it. It's actually inspired by a game that came out about 15 years ago on the GBA in Europe and Japan called Kurakura Kururin, which is a very similar sort of a spinning stick going around a level mechanic. But theirs was a very thin stick controlled by a bird as a helicopter, and each level was separate instead of the open world that we do. And it was, like, it was very, very demanding. Like, if Roundabout was, like, the challenging version of that, then that's kind of like the Dark Souls, like, impossible insanity version where you're going down incredibly narrow corridors and having to precise time and everything. So we're kind of in comparison, a sloppy version of that, but still a pretty... pretty demanding sort of puzzle game.
Well, it's welcoming both to sloppy play and a precise play. I mean, because you can blow up over and over and over and you never go back farther than the nearest checkpoint, but if you want to 100% any of the missions, which I only did with the first couple, you have to, you know, be very, very precise and, you know your angles and know your routes and all that kind of rewarding, you know, OCD-friendly stuff.
Yeah, that's super deliberate as well. Like, we, from kind of the start, we wanted to make sure that dying was a really fun thing to do because it happens constantly. And so anything that's an impediment to that, we kind of pushed to all of our secondary mechanics. So not dying on a ride is a little check mark you get instead of it being a failure state. And, you know, time limits and things like that are also things that go on this, like, how's your driving card? That if you're terrible and you just want to play through and, like, jam your way through, that's totally fine. You'll get a low percentage, but you'll be able to progress. But if you want to do that sort of high skill thing, we give like a way for you to do that without sort of blocking people who don't necessarily want to have that challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is refreshing. I mean, like you mentioned Dark Souls, and one thing that's been talked about with Dark Souls 2 is that you can set your own difficulty to a higher degree than you could with the first game with various items and changing the penalties for death. My go-to example is always Bastion and Transistor, where you can literally decide which part of the game you would like to make harder at a given time. I think more of that is good. And the check marks were kind of, you know, it was the opposite way in, but the same effect for me, because if I wanted to attempt a completionist run, then I could. And if I wanted to attempt a speed run, I could. And, you know, it was very welcoming to trying different stuff in rapid succession.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to have worked out pretty well. And it works out for me as well, because I am not the kind of person that can play through Dark Souls. I was actually watching Actually, just before we started talking, I was watching through some of the Games Done Quick stuff and watching the Rogue Legacy playthrough. Rogue Legacy is a game I've probably put like 15 hours in and I haven't beaten the boss yet because I'm just terrible at it. And then they go through and they do it on their first character 5 minutes in. And so I will never be like that. So I kind of need to allow people like me to play the games I make.
Yeah, well, it's a game, like you said, it's fun to blow up. You know, I really love hard games. I've put a lot of hours into Spelunky, I've put a lot of hours into The Binding of Isaac, a lot of hours into the Dark Souls games, and all of that. Rogue Legacy as well, I like Rogue Legacy a lot. But, to me, those games tend to lose me if they're not fun to be bad at. This actually kind of came up for me with Crypt of the Necrodancer, the rhythm roguelike, because until a pretty recent build, it was not fun to be bad at it. There's kind of a slightly wider margin of error available now, and it makes all the difference, because if you can't enjoy failing horribly, there's no means for getting better, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of one of the sort of endgame roguelike problems, I guess. Like, that's my reason I shelved FTL was because my skill isn't good enough to beat the final, ship in that. And so, to get to that point, I have to burn 45 minutes to, get to that point and fail again. And that kind of, it's kind of a disincentive at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the early parts end up feeling so slow and sloggy. And it's like, well, I've done this. And you know, you could be doing things to put yourself in a better position later, but that's not what's interesting to you. It can be an issue. Yeah. So Roundabout doesn't have that problem, right? Because it keeps everything bite-size.
You'll be dying constantly. So it's the loss of progress is basically just to your last checkpoint, and those are like every 5 to 10 seconds, essentially. So we use a kind of an encounter design model, essentially, if you want to the nerdy insider design terms we use for it. And so everything is like we have a small puzzle chunk that's an encounter, and if you get past it, great, you don't have to do it again.
And it's sort of instanced in the sense that there are those extra collectibles on the map while you have a passenger, and then they're not there if you're just in the overworld. Some of them are, exactly. But some of them are not. Yeah.
Yeah, and we use those. When you're starting off in the game, we use those to kind of show you where to go, and then as that goes later on, we kind of branch out and use them to hint where some of some extra things are, or maybe some harder parts you have to take, or things like that.
Yeah, some of the most fun I had early in the game was realizing I could get the 48 combo chain achievement, and unlock by doing the first two rides perfectly. Right, like if I was really, really fast about that and I just did them and then I rushed right from one to the next, then I could do it. So I did this mini speed run as I was getting to know the game, and that was awesome. So it's again friendly to that kind of noticing patterns.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of something our scoring system was based around as well. Like we initially designed it after Tony Hawk, where instead of doing tricks, you were picking up those pickups to increase your multiplier. And then stuff like people and small objects were basically the manual equivalent that would keep your streak going. And right at the start, we actually leaned probably a little too heavily on that. And so stuff like where you're talking about, where you could complete, if you complete the first two rides perfectly, you keep your streak through all of them. Originally, I wanted to try and see if we could do a perfect line through the entire game.
Oh, God.
Where if you could do it without hitting, you'd have some crazy multiplier, but... There's just so many things you have to compromise to get that through. But that's also where a lot of our sort of basic design decisions from, why our end results are just a little top third that comes down and not a blocking screen and things like that, because we wanted to make sure that you're always moving.
Sure, yeah. That challenge sounds daunting. I think there's some ring you get in Dark Souls 2 for playing the entire game without dying or something. It's that level of crazy.
So, yeah, it's insanity.
Would it be fair to say that that kind of sensibility about, it's as hard as you want it to be, you can go for the ridiculous challenges, but you can also enjoy it if you're not game, would it be fair to say that that comes from your experience on the Rock Band series to a certain degree? Because that's definitely a series that sort of, I don't know if it pioneered that style, but it perfected it in a certain party game way.
It's definitely an inspiration for it. Like, it's one of those things where... seeing people playing on easy and enjoy it even though there's nothing there, or the no fail stuff we put into RB2 onwards were kind of big influences on that. Originally I was on the anti side of no fail, believe it or not, until we got it in and saw people playing it, just because it does remove it's the classic hardcore gamer of it. It's like, oh my god, this removes challenge, why would you want this in? But it's less about challenge and more about accessibility, and it doesn't really compromise that in a way. So I think a lot of sort of design model that Panzer and I used when we were designing Roundabout was making sure that it's fun and accessible first, and then the challenge is an extended set of mechanics rather than a core mechanic.
Yeah, because with Rock Band 2, I've definitely spent many pleasant hours trying to Gold Star things, but I think probably the best times I've ever had with a Rock Band game were in no-fail mode with Rock Band 3, where I hooked up my MIDI keyboard, and there were multiple singers, and just anybody who happened to be over could participate. And, you know, some of us were being virtuosos, and some of us weren't, and it kind of didn't matter, and that was great. Because the system is robust enough that it's not just about, you know, failure or success. So, anyway. That's me being a slight fanboy, so apologies for that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so this is No Goblin's first release, right? This is your first release as an independent developer, yeah?
That's correct. Yeah, it's our first game. We did a bunch of like prank releases, and we're also behind the Men of Game Development calendar, so we've done other non-game things weirdly before we released our first game. But yeah, No Goblin is Panzer and myself basically making independent games and making them with like original themes and settings. So you're not going to see a fantasy No Goblin game or like a space, you know, space lasers No Goblin game.
Hence No Goblin. It could have been called No Orc or no Space Zombie as well.
Yeah, the name's actually inspired by the creative director at my last job at Twisted Pixel, is Josh Bear. And his way of talking about like that kind of stuff, like is that you get 25 XP on your sword is a totally goblin thing, and so it's like we don't want any goblins in this game. It's kind of like a trademark Josh thing. So when I left to co-found a studio, like we were struggling to come up with a name. It's like, well, what's the kind of games we want to make? It's like, we want to make games that, you know, we don't make like not goblin-y games, and that's kind of like where No Goblin came from / was lifted from.
That's great. That's actually a really good kind of axis on which to think about game design, because there's definitely I appreciate games that are no goblin, that are goblin free, but I also appreciate games that twist gobliny mechanics in interesting ways. I was just playing Dungeon of the Endless last night, and that's the, you know, Amplitude, the team that made Endless Space and Endless Legend, taking some of their core mechanics, and I think literally they like got drunk and put it all in a blender, and not a literal blender, but literally drunk, and, you know, thought about how can we twist this stuff in weird ways and use our signature resources and RPG mechanics in a way that feels, you know, different and chaotic and interesting, and it works pretty good.
Yeah, I've keep seeing it pop up in my feed now and again, so I need to. Once we're done with Xbox and PlayStation and all those kind of fun things, that may be on my post console roundabout break.
I think you'd enjoy it based on what I know about you and what I've read on Giant Bomb about your taste in games, which I do want to talk a little bit about your 2014 list, because your number one pick excited me. But before I forget, Dungeon of the Endless is a really interesting case, because it involves, you know, roguelike stuff, which can be very goblin. Along with tower defense stuff, which, not to lift your term, but can be quite goblin as well, and then RPG, you know, party based stuff, which is the goblinist. but it puts it all together in a way that, again, is fun to fail at, and is very daunting, and that's always a good thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so your number one pick, for anybody who has not read your Giant Bomb article, which I'll link to in the notes of this episode, you said it was a tie between Fibbage and Drawful, which are two of the games from the Jackbox Party Pack. So that I'm not, you know, quoting you to yourself or anything, would you mind saying real quick why you picked those games?
For me, I think it's because it's like playing through Drawful and playing through Fibbage. It's kind of the path for how multiplayer, like how sort of couch multiplayer needs to progress. Like for better or for worse, like Rock Band kind of destroyed any chance of like extended peripheral stuff at retail, and going over to someone's house and making sure that they have four controllers and getting them enrolled into the game and stuff like that. It's like this burden that sort of comes across as like this super nerdy thing to do at a party. Whereas something like Fibbage, like I've actually bought Fibbage 3 times now over the course of like 6 months, just because of the different platforms, and they released an XL edition. But it's basically your phone is your controller, and you just, when you want to play, you just pull out your phone and go to, you know, jackbox.tv or whatever the URL is, and you're in. Which I think is like, it solves so many problems that party game designers have struggled with in terms of investment cost or barriers to entry or matchmaking. These problems that are just tough problems to solve basically don't exist anymore, which is fantastic. And it's also an easy way to sort of do couch multiplayer in an environment where maybe publishers aren't necessarily willing to fund it because of those hurdles, or people aren't necessarily making games that are couch multiplayer friendly because of those hurdles. And this is, to me, seemed like a really awesome way to basically destroy those hurdles and like usher in a new era of that. For if you'll excuse my rambling take on it.
No, that's a really good. I hadn't thought of it as the anti Rock Band in terms of interface, but it sort of is, right? Because instead of needing dedicated peripherals that you can maybe use for one or two other games and probably not even that, the controller is something whatever thing everyone happens to already have in their pocket anyway. There's always the one person at the party who doesn't have a smartphone because they're just too cool, but that's why you keep an iPad in the house and they can still play the Jackbox Party Pack.
Exactly.
But it's genius, and it's Fibbage and Drawful, I think, are especially brilliant uses of it because the potential latency between devices doesn't matter. With You Don't Know Jack, or to a certain degree even Lieswater, it kind of does. Jack attacks can get contentious in the Jackbox Party Pack, because I've noticed anybody with an iPhone just is a little bit behind, and it can be a little bit unfair. But with Fibbage and Drawful, it just doesn't matter. Like, it's designed around there being that little bit of delay, and it just works. It even works on Twitch or Steam Broadcast, which I've.
I think that's the most impressive part is, like, with Twitch's 30-second delay, you're still having really great, useful games with this, which is kind of mind blowing to me.
Yeah, no, I've been a really big fan of the Jackbox / Jellyvision guys since the first You Don't Know Jack, and it's interesting to see them innovating along that line, because I wouldn't have sort of it makes total sense, because You Don't Know Jack was already a game that I played around a screen with people. I don't know, if they update the Jackbox Party Pack so that you can play Jack and Lieswater with controllers, which some of us nerds do have, it'll be the perfect thing, and I'll, have no complaints about anything in the world. Because that's what's really interesting to me about the Jackbox Party Pack, is that it's an intermediate step. It puts its toe in this new kind of, no friction, no special equipment necessary form of couch and party. This new kind of gaming, but it's not there yet, because not all of the games in there are quite built to function in that new world,
Yeah, it's in some ways it's an experimental release, which it seems like a weird thing to say, because Fibbage and Drawful are they're incredibly solid packages, and especially Drawful as well is a super robust sort of example of how you do a drawing game, but they kind of almost like this sort of prototype of the kinds of things that you can do with phone interaction on next gen consoles.
Really, really interesting stuff. And it's funny, because you were the other thing about the friction. I had a friend who was going to bring in his Xbox One to play the Jackbox Party Pack, and then I was like, well, it's out on Steam. I just have it on my work laptop right here. And that blew his mind as well, because he was still, at my work, someone brings in the Wii U and we have a Smash Brothers day, and somebody brings in this, somebody brings in that. We're all very used to having to schlep purpose-built equipment, in order to play a certain kind of game. And, it was just this moment of exactly what you're describing, although I didn't think of it that way at the time. It eliminates that, and it's great.
No, it's fantastic, and I'm really, really excited to see kind of, the next wave of both Jackbox and everyone who kind of gets in on that sort of genre, I guess, to see what's next.
So I assume you have not really had time to play anything recently, because you've just been head down kind of getting a game finished and then dealing with post-release kind of stuff.
I've been kind of crazy. I've been slowly returning to normality. I've just started getting into Shadow of Mordor, which, despite this goblin content, I'm totally getting into.
It's very goblin, but it's very good. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen a bunch of people go I'm not a big Lord of the Rings guy, but this is it's Batman combat in open world, and the Nemesis system is fantastic, and all of the other things that put it on everyone else's Game of the Year list. It probably would have been on my Game of the Year list if I'd played it in time. It's fantastic.
I thought it was really, that was another fascinating one as far as being kind of a lungfish or being in two worlds at once. Because it's, when I was playing the main story, I really kind of didn't like it. I thought it was very kind of sloggy, and I didn't really care about the characters and all that stuff. But as soon as it let me just, you know, puppet master orc society, it was a blast. It was like one of the best things I'd ever played. Like the less it asked me to care about, you know, the through line, the more fun I was having.
Yeah, I think I'm still pretty early on in it, but like at the same time, it's like that first like couple of hours, I was just trying to get a sense of what the hell is going on. Yeah. And then like I just finished the rat bag missions, and now he's the war chief. And so like I'm now at the point where it's like, okay, I kind of get how this stuff is going on, and you know, maybe I should take care of this stuff before I die, because this guy's just gonna level up forever otherwise, and things like that. So like now that I kind of have a sense of how things are going, I'm kind of going down the same thing where I don't really want to hit the story missions. I just want to go through and, you know, do this chain of stuff and get my runes and, you know, be a dick to some goblin captain somewhere.
You've got to be a dick. I mean, there's no, yeah. And I also, the other thing I love is if you have a plan to be a dick one way, I think to me, this is like the core difference between the story missions and just the sort of, emergent play of the game, is that if I have a plan to say, like, you know, help a guy win a duel, and that goes horribly wrong and he gets killed, I can then just go ahead and enact a new plan involving the guy who won the duel. Like, the game doesn't stop or tell me I failed a mission. It just keeps going under new, interesting, possibly horrible, but always fun conditions. So I respect that about it a lot.
Yeah, I think that's probably where my next month of random grabs of gameplay is probably going to go. So I'll slowly get my game stack reduced over time.
Fair enough. Yeah, I'm sure making games is a great way to not have as much time to play them.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, making games, like, I was used to, like, it basically having a stack of games for 6 months, just, like, working at like, other places. And then as soon as, like, Go Indie and we were doing, like, business stuff and things like that, I've kind of almost lost, like, having a normal life, I guess. And so, like, it's like, I can play games, or I could go outside maybe today. I don't know. So it's been it's been kind of weird losing sense of time and what games are out and what movies are out and things like that. So I'm kind of very, very much looking forward to reestablishing a life at some point this year.
I take it, based on that it's too early to talk about what No Goblin might make next. Yeah, you're probably just taking a moment to breathe.
Kind of. Like, we have a pretty good idea of what we're going to make next, and we've been very, you know, quietly pitching it around. We're probably going to pitch it a bit more at GDC, just to see if we want to, you know, partner up with a publisher. Which is kind of a similar thing that we did with Roundabout as well before we decided to self-publish. But yeah, that's kind of basically my sort of Panzer and I's part-time thing while we're finishing up the Xbox One version and PS4 and Vita.
Gotcha. Yeah, that'd be a really fun thing to have on Vita. Just have it around.
Yeah, it's fun, and also a ton of work taking a DirectX 11, you know, Xbox One and PS4 game and fitting it on this hardware that's basically, you know, mobile from a year or two ago.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure. Yeah. I guess I can't really picture it working from a control perspective on actual, like, without anything but a touch interface. It takes some work, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, luckily that, you know, the Vita's got, you know, decent sticks and decent triggers, so it's more just crunching it down rather than having to reinvent everything.
Right, definitely. Yeah, it's not going to be like a Super Meat Boy Forever thing where you have to completely rethink, you know, what you control and what you don't or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've not had much time to play games, you've not had much time to watch movies. I'm assuming you've still been plugged into game culture, though, which has been in a weird place the last year, right? Like, I'm trying to figure out how to talk to everybody about this, because I think it's just everybody's kind of taking stock, and it, you know, if you don't even want to talk about this, that's completely fine. But I guess I just find it interesting to talk to people who are making games about the fact that the medium is more vibrant and more interesting and all of that than it's ever been before. And there's this backlash in progress, you know what I mean? Sort of, you know, 10 steps forward, 2 steps back. And it's created a very weird atmosphere where I find myself really excited to talk about stuff on Twitter, and other people are excited to talk about it too. And then every 10th guy, you know, acts like I'm planting a flag against everything he believes in simply by talking about interesting indie games. It's a weird, weird time to kind of live online.
I think a lot of it is, for me, is more that Twitter as a communication environment isn't what it was 3 years ago. It's just like that sort of the natural evolution of a social network, I guess. It's just like back to like 3 or 4 years ago, there was like a smaller amount of people, and it was like more of a community that would talk. Whereas now, it's basically noise. Like I found, in the last couple of months, I found myself not having my Twitter client open 24/7. Which, if you told me that 2 years ago, would have been insanity. And I think a lot of it also has just been like I've been so busy that like I barely have time to like if I'm trying to figure out what I'm gonna do for half an hour of my time, it's interacting on Twitter with people is probably further down the list than like doing other things.
Yeah, no, perfectly fair. Especially if the other thing on the list is to see the sun. I'm sure,
exactly.
Yeah, Twitter definitely can't compete with that. And it's interesting. I wonder if maybe every social network is going to go through this process where once advertisers figure out how to use it, there's a ticking clock of when it becomes more noise than signal. Because I think part of what's made Twitter so noisy is everyone trying to participate in hashtags and do SEO and just do all this meta stuff that has nothing to do with saying interesting things and linking to interesting articles and so on,
I'm actually super surprised that Twitter hasn't, like that transition hasn't happened yet, given how sort of anti-user Twitter has been with, locking down the API and, not really caring about, moderation tools and, very aggressively trying to monetize Twitter. Like, it's the kind of thing where, you saw from, MySpace to Facebook to Twitter, I guess to Tumblr, if that's the path that it's going. Like, it surprised me that it's like maybe Twitter's like the first one that's actually established a real critical mass for real instant discussion, and there hasn't really been anything to usurp that, which is kind of weird, I guess. It's like they're in the World of Warcraft position for social networks.
they are. They're non-optional, right? Like even I've talked to a lot of people who say they use Twitter less, but I've not talked to anybody so far who says they've quit Twitter.
No, I've been on the verge of canceling my Facebook just because, why bother? Essentially, is the only reason I use it is basically to keep in touch with non-gaming friends back home in Australia. Whereas as part of my job, I need to be on Twitter. I need to be able to promote our work and interact with a community, and the closest I can think of to that is Tumblr, and even that's a distant second to Twitter interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Twitter, the thing that makes it so useful is also the thing that can make it, it seems almost dumb and tautological to say that, a 140 character at a time communication tool can be reductive, but that's the thing, right? Like it allows for the removal of context and the, I don't know, I mean, like Storify is a really interesting development to me, right? The idea that you can string a bunch of tweets together and make them kind of an article, sort of, but it reads like a very bad article then because it's choppy, because that's the wrong place, Twitter, to write a long form piece. Yet that's where so much communication happens that we need a tool to reconstitute, aphorisms into articles. It's weird. It's a strange moment.
Yeah, Storify stuff, regardless of subject, it starts to, at least to me, starts to feel like sort of the A Beautiful Mind moment of red lines connecting through tweets, through threads. It's like I'm getting old. I don't have as much focus as I used to. I need my linear sort of media more and more.
Yeah, I feel old too when people quote some they place some quote on Twitter as an image, I guess to make it bigger or easier to increase virality or something. It's a big Facebook trick too, and I just give me a link to a thing with words that I can maybe copy paste if I want to or access later. I feel
that's,
very old.
That's actually been the toughest thing as a developer, is that trend is now going into developer documentation. So if I want to, this is probably a really great example for our input library for Roundabout, the code examples for how to use some of this stuff is in a 15-minute YouTube video where the guy brings up a text editor in the YouTube video and types it out. As I want to just copy and paste that chunk and put it in my code, but instead I'm pausing a YouTube video on one monitor and dictating it into my code view. It's kind of insane.
Yeah, that's such a clean and great example. Yeah, it's and I find myself transcribing stuff from YouTube videos, like you say, almost as though I'm doing a text version of an audio interview, when it's just communicating information that it's on the internet, for God's sake, so it ought to be copy-pastable, it ought to be easily accessible, but it, yeah, it's... We sound old right now, FYI. Not that we're wrong, we just do sound old.
Yeah. Back in my day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I suppose not that long ago, right? Like, back in the day that was slightly probably before yours and my day, you were still dictating because you had a paper book with code snippets in it, right?
Well, yeah, that was, like, the start of my, like, game dev career back in the ancient 90s.
Oh, my. Was, oh, my.
Yeah.
Very goblin, like, back then. Yes, I'm sorry to keep using it. I just got kind of enchanted with it.
But it was especially worse in Australia because, like, shipping books is, like, way expensive to do across the Pacific. So it'd be like $90 to get, you know, a Brash's, you know, book on such and such, or, you know, I basically have to pick and choose which books I wanted to get to sort of learn stuff. Yeah, it's kind of insane, like, comparing making games like 15, 16 years ago, where it's like we had a, you know, single a monochrome monitor hooked up to a serial port for debug, and we're doing level design in C++ and stuff like that, to now, whereas, like, making games is now the easy part of making games.
Sure. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. I mean, I think I've said on this podcast before, the, you know, quoted Clay Shirky, that the use of a given piece of technology can't become interesting until the technology itself becomes boring. So games are naturally going to become, not that they weren't interesting before, of course, but they're going to naturally be, there's going to be a wider variety of uses for the medium of games once, making games is the easy part of making games.
Yeah, it's like something that's kind of interesting, like, at least from, like, us old ex-AAA people as well. It's like I learned to be a designer through, like, my leads and through other people, like, through design teams and through, like, you know, propagation of that information. And even today, I don't really have a sense of, like, a good place for me to send someone to learn about the basics of game design. Like, game design courses really aren't teaching this stuff. They're all very sort of, you know, engine specific rather than mechanic specific, and there isn't really, like, a central repository to, you know, talk about, you know, Fitts' law in, you know, human user interaction, or, like, why we balance, you know, for encounter design versus other design, or things like that. And it's, I'm kind of curious to see how game design as a discipline evolves when you don't have like elders propagating that information down to new hires.
It seems like, yeah, there's been a folklorical aspect to how it gets passed down previously, and now there's a little bit of a disconnect where you have people being really serious about the form of games, about the way they tell stories and that kind of thing, but those people, a lot of them anyway, are not literate in code. And, you know, I put myself in that category to a certain degree, right? Like, I work with Java at work. I know, like, the smallest measurable amount of C, but I'm not a developer, you know, and I'm really interested in video games as a consumer of them, and as someone who's, like, read a lot of the theory and all that. But there's relatively few people in that space who are also coders. And on the other side of that coin, there are people who are mostly interested, as you say, in engine specific tutorials and how to make a thing happen in a game or for a game. And they're never the twain meet, except maybe when Ian Bogost does stuff, you know?
Yeah. And, like, I guess, you know, at some point, like, a bunch of us have to start writing this stuff down before we die, so it doesn't get lost to time. But it's a weird situation to be in, I guess. But, I mean, it's a good one, since it's, you know, it means, it's, like, the amount of people who can make games is now drastically, you know, bigger than the amount of people that can teach the, you know, specifics of becoming a huge master at such and stuff, and, you know, things like that. But yeah, it's a weird time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, not least because there's that old, I mean, it's not completely true, of course, but the old saw about how those who can't teach, but what if everyone can? Then nobody's gonna bother to teach. So
yeah, exactly.
The other thing that's interesting right now is just the variety of tones that are available in games. I think wasn't that long ago, I'm not sure what year it actually was, maybe 2012, that Rock Paper Shotgun made that comment about how they loved Space Funeral. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's an RPG Maker game by a guy who calls himself the Catamites. It's extremely weird. It really kind of captures the feeling of a badly translated game, and kind of, like, it's surreal and interesting. And I go on this long walk to say that Rock Paper Shotgun, or one of the writers for it, made the comment that it was one of the first games they've played that felt like it was for someone. It was, you know, it was supposed to be communicating with, like, the kind of person who reads Akewood. There was an intended audience, there was an intended tone, and there just wasn't that much of that, particularly in the AAA space, but maybe in games generally. And now, not that many years later, I feel like there's a ton of that. And there's, you know, you can play a game where you are a lesbian spider queen on Mars, and you can play, you know, Gone Home exists, and Shadow of Mordor exists, and there's all these different tones that were not available before. And I feel like Roundabout is a really, really good example of that, because I've never played a game that quite looks or sounds, but more to the point, that quite feels like Roundabout. It's got an aesthetic that's all its own with the 70s stuff and the particular way the graphics are rendered and the FMVs, and it's something I couldn't even imagine someone not just being able to have the money to make, but almost thinking to make not that long ago, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of it also comes down to just like team size reduction as well. Like, it's like, you know, even back, you know, 10 years ago, like, it was like people were making games that they wanted to play, like ignoring, you know, crazy, you know, focused group targeted stuff. So like stuff like Destroy All Humans, like that was, you know, that was something that like we wanted to make that was, you know, reflected our personalities and our things, and was something we wanted to make for a particular audience, but it's 40 people making that game. And at that point, you don't really have a sense of authorship towards tone, I guess. Like it's there's a lot of influences coming in, and the result that comes out is a little diffuse because of it.
Yeah, fair point. I mean, Destroy All Humans is not a game that I would ever describe as feeling like it was designed by committee, but even so, it maybe has less individuality than Roundabout overall.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of that is because Roundabout is just Panzer and I. So like 50% of that tone is me, and 50% of that tone is her. And we're both, you know, we have similar likes and like similar ideas of like how we wanted to like, you know, hit this group, like this kind of feel we wanted to go for. So there isn't, like, it's very focused on the kind of things that we wanted to do. And there isn't, you know, there isn't a publishing team going, well, if you want to hit, you know, if you want to, you know, position it over this way, then you need to, you know, add, you know, more combat elements or things like that. Which is a double-edged sword, because, like, on one hand, we're making something that's super unique and no one's ever played before, but on the other hand, we have to position something that's super unique and no one's ever played before, which makes it a harder sell, which is something that you're not going to see in AAA.
Right. Yeah, I feel like the best way to sell it is actually to talk about the tone or the things. I actually got one friend to buy it by saying that the central relationship in it, and this is a weird comparison even as I'm saying it now, but the central relationship feels a little bit like the central romantic relationship in Welcome to Night Vale, just in that there's this queer relationship at the center of it that is the only sane or normal thing in the universe, and it liberates that relationship from having to be what the story is about and just kind of makes it the center and just about people in the midst of a world that kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I've never really sort of compared it to Night Vale before, Yeah, that's a pretty good comparison.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Cecil talks a bit more than Giorgio does, but, you know, otherwise.
Yeah, here and there. Yeah,
yeah, now and then. Yeah. So I really liked that, though, and I thought that the whole aesthetic is almost too narrow a word, the whole feel of the game really kind of celebrated the way that, you know, slightly dodgy production or slightly schlocky aesthetics or aesthetics considered that can be inclusive and allow a space for weird, crazy stuff, you know, like talking skeletons and revolving limousines and things like that. That there's an openness to embracing something that doesn't look like polished things are supposed to look. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I think it's a kind of a reflection of like both of our personalities, I guess, because like we're into incredibly dumb stuff, and so it's kind of this outward expression of that, and it's something that kind of scared us a lot before we started showing people. It's like, are we racing our entire lives? Are we going to be homeless in 2 years' time because we decided to make a game with a plastic $40 Amazon skeleton and we're the only people in the world who'll find this funny? Thankfully other people found it funny too, so we can still live for a little bit longer.
I'm very glad about all of the above, because yeah, I definitely find it funny. I think part of what makes it so good is that so much of it is good-natured. You know what I mean? Like, it's even the stuff that is kind of dark is always with just an eye toward general movie/video game mayhem, right? Like, I don't think there's a single joke in the thing that's mean-spirited.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point. And I think a lot of that is just because that's not really the kind of games we like to make. I personally probably couldn't make a serious game or like a game that's kind of a little bit mean like that, I guess. Not because I didn't want to, but like I don't think I could take myself seriously long enough to write a script to that's talking about end of the world-esque style stuff, or like putting down some, you know, poor guy somewhere without it just like cracking a joke or like dropping a few puns in. So I think that's it's nice that sort of good natured fun games work, because otherwise I'd be in a lot of trouble.
I will not send you my roundabout transistor crossover fanfiction then. I'll keep that to myself.
Okay, maybe send it to Panzer and she can
okay, she can vet it. sounds good to me. Yeah, it's actually the one thing that I'm curious to hear, you know, the design decision. Obviously the way you score points, right, not multipliers but the base points, is mostly by running over pedestrians, and that's the one part that sometimes felt like a little bit at odds with the rest of the tone, because everything is so good-natured that, you know, have people kind of screaming and running away and exploding. I felt like what I took away from it was that that's kind of the schlocky aesthetic of video games. That's like the mayhem, the Tony Hawk, the, you know, the big sandbox world cartoon violence thing. And it didn't bug me. It just seemed like an interesting choice, because everything else, Like I enjoyed the dissonance of the fact that that, you know, the people in the FMV are categorically different from the people you're just running over. But, you know, when I tried to put those two ideas in my head at the same time, it could get weird. I actually, on the last Beth mission, there just happened to be a pedestrian standing right in the middle of the mission circle. And I totally hit that pedestrian and totally thought I'd killed Beth for like half a second. And I was furious at myself. And I was like, oh, God, you can't save scum in this game. What am I going to do?
But that was actually something that was, it was like an inadvertent kind of challenge that we weren't really prepared for. Like originally we were thinking of, oh, when the ride ends, well, the passenger should get out of the limo and run away. But like crossing the streams like that never really worked. And I think it's kind of good we didn't, like we deliberately kind of put that wall between it, just because like it kind of reinforces how goofy everything else is around Giorgio.
And it's, you know, I mean, it acknowledges the dark, because that's the only thing that's dark humor, right? Like I said, the whole thing is so, like we're both saying, the whole thing is so good natured that, you know, to have a minor spoiler, I suppose, to have a flaming skeleton instruct you to go run over a bunch of people on a beach acknowledges that, okay, this is kind of weird, and this is a place video games ask you to go more often than other media, but that doesn't necessarily kill the tone. It's just like a strange thing that we're all prepared for and is part of the fun.
And I think the other thing that makes it work is that the people aren't really scared that this is going on. They're kind of resigned that, you know, this is things like there's a line in there. It's like, this is the third time this week. And it's like
they keep counting, don't they? I feel like someone got as high as this is the 30th time this week. Maybe that, but
there's a bunch in there. There's like 700 or 800 lines that we all crowdsourced in for people yelling. So there's a bunch of different numbers in there, but their death is an inconvenience to them. Like they're not really scared at all, but more like annoyed that they have to go into this comical blood patch, or, you know, triangle patch if you have no violence on.
Yeah, totally. I felt like they were annoyed that they were going to have to walk back to work from the respawn point. Not that they were like dying, right? Like it's
exactly. Yeah.
I think my favorite one was and I think, I don't know if I timed it perfectly or if it was just a beautifully recorded piece of dialogue, but there's a male voice that goes, "Oh, cool, a revolving limousine," and then always SWAT.
It's actually been weird. We have to fill out all of our rating certificates and stuff for shipping on console, and it's looking like we're probably going to be PEGI 18.
Really?
But just because we have pedestrians that you can run over, and I guess that's because of a GTA reaction that they have a specific category for pedestrians you can run over because they assume it's going to be real life and gory. But even though our entire aesthetic is cartoony and like there's no Gibbs or there's, you know, everyone's really happy, we're probably gonna put an 18 on the box, well, on the digital box for roundabout on Xbox One, which is, it kind of like blows my mind that like that's how, yeah, it blows my mind that we have an 18 rating for our cartoon FMV insanity.
When I think of the kind of crazy, legitimately pretty violent stuff that gets a teen rating, you know, frequently over here, wow, that's crazy. That's completely nuts. That's completely nuts. And it shows that there's a certain expectation about, and a not totally unearned expectation, unfortunately, that in video games, if it's a possibility for you to be, you know, attacking humanoid things that are not attacking you back, then there's something prurient or bad about it, right? And I want to dismiss that and say, like, that's something gaming's kind of over, but that game hatred did, in fact, get greenlit. Or put on green light, then taken off, then put back, then green light, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the scary thing about that is that it's, well, scary, I guess it's the thing that reflects that more is, like, it's not only was it greenlit, but it's, like, greenlit within 2 hours with 12,000 people, like, dumping in votes, which is, I guess, kind of a reflection of that audience that can attract.
Yeah, yeah, and whether even, man, if it's a smaller audience than that suggests, and they just, like, were spamming with different IP addresses and stuff, that's actually kind of scarier. Yeah, I don't know. It's lame. And I don't know if you've been following it all, and I don't mean to ruin your day, but there are people who were involved in greenlighting Hatred who are now asking on a pretty much daily basis for, you know, NPCs to kill in the game that look like the people who've been, you know, kind of standing up against Gamergate. Which is upsetting for a number of reasons.
Yeah, that's pretty upsetting.
Yeah. Wow, we had such a pleasant conversation.
Wow, everything was going so well.
Damn it.
So well.
Oh, God, I need my Jeffrey pills. This is not my Jeffrey medicine, that's what it's called, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, sorry. I, you know, so this is the first interview one of these I've done since all that you know, bullshit started, so I feel like it's on my mind. So sorry if that's been haunting this conversation, which I've otherwise found pretty damn pleasant. So don't mean to bring it down.
That's okay. That's what hopefully games like Roundabout will put some cheer into people's life.
Oh my god, it's so true, because the other game I was getting ready to interview somebody about at the time that that I got in touch with you about Roundabout was This War of Mine. If you play those two games back to back, you will experience the full range of what video games have to offer, emotionally speaking, right?
Yeah, that's some whiplash right there.
Oh my god, it was, I had to segregate, because I played you know, both for the first time on the same day and just didn't know what to do with myself for like 18 hours. I was just a mess. Yeah.
I've been putting off playing This World of Mine just because it's like everyone's raving about it, but I don't know if I can handle something that's depressing. I might just have to grab some Kleenex and sit down and play some.
I mean, it's a pretty incredible game, but it's we were talking about how, you know, we like games that are fun to lose at. I'm not sure if there isn't much hope in This War of Mine, or if I'm just not good enough to get to the hopeful parts yet. You know what I mean? But yeah. Either way, losing at it is a compelling experience for sure. But fun is not the word I would use by any stretch. You know?
Yeah, you endure a session, I guess.
You do. Yeah, you come away with something, but you come away having lost something as well, I think. But then, you know, Roundabout exists to sort of restore that sense of whimsy. So thank you. Like, genuinely, this sounds cheesy, but thank you for making it, because it's a thing that I didn't know I wanted until I had it. I had no idea that I wanted an FMV game about a revolving limousine driver, but you know, damned if I didn't. So,
well, super glad you liked it. We just have to figure out how to tell everyone else about it.
Yeah, so I mean, so you know, thanks again for being here, because I would like the world to know about this game, and I think I know a lot of people who would like it quite a bit, who like me just, you know, don't realize that this is the game they've been waiting for to liven up a few of their evenings. And I definitely, by the way, I think I mentioned how friendly the game is to my OCD. I'm gonna go back and get a lot of collectibles which are still yet to be gotten. I was pretty careful about getting all the star coins on the missions, but there's sick jumps out there. There's cash stashes. I have a long, long way to go.
Yeah, there's a couple. I think it's just under 2,000 collectibles all off. So yeah, we've got a ton of collecting to do.
and I will enjoy doing it. Damn it. Is there anything you want to plug other than Roundabout itself?
Besides Roundabout, like I mentioned earlier, we're also behind the Men of Game Development calendar, which is 12 half-naked men of game development from, like, Manveer, from BioWare. John Romero's in the calendar this year. If you go to menofgamedev.com, you'll see the models for this year. I have a box or two of those calendars remaining that I would like to get out of my house, so please buy a calendar.
That is the best sales pitch I've ever. Okay, yeah, great. Okay, yeah, Men of Game Dev, sounds good. Okay, well, thank you one more time, and have a good one.
Awesome, thanks.
And that's the show. Roundabout is currently available on Steam and in the Humble Store, and will soon be available as well on Xbox One and PlayStation 4, and later also on PlayStation Vita. You can check out the Men of Game Dev calendar at menofgamedev.com. I picture, and I don't have too much basis for picturing this, but I imagine that Dan is completely just up to his neck in these calendars, physical printed calendars that bear the semi-nude likenesses of people he knows or has worked with, and he really needs his apartment back, so please buy the calendars. That's, I think, what his pitch basically was. It looks like Phil Tipitoski was on the 2014 calendar. You've heard him on this podcast. Darren Korb is Mr. November in 2015, and he wrote the music for Bastion and Transistor, so he's been on the podcast, kinda. His music has. So, yeah, there's that. Speaking of this podcast, you can subscribe to it anywhere RSS works or touches. iTunes, Stitcher, I'd normally say Podbay, but Podbay seems to be kind of losing its mind lately with pop-ups and things, so maybe not there right now. But you can also, if you're on the island of Grenada, contemplate the strange semi-colonial extra-legal history of the United States intervening in Grenada, maybe make a shrine to Ronald Reagan, light a candle, and hear the podcast emanating from the smoke that billows out from said prayer candle. Ben, give it a try. Or you can always just go to etao.wordpress.com.